Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2022. Today, capital and money. The lecture is the finishing touch on chapter 2, and I will be going through some definitions here and make sure that you write down what I say, because in some cases there are versions of these definitions on the internet that are just absolutely wrong, and that people think, well, I can sneak to the internet and get an answer, and they'll find out that I've set it up so that that answer is there for them to give, but then they lose the points, and then they get all angry and send me, tell me why this is a wrong answer, because I said it was in class, you moron. I don't say it like that. I'm supposed to be really nice. Yes, I do say it like that. Okay, before we go into the lecture, we are going to look at the numbers a little bit here. Well, let's try that again. The numbers are not showing. Okay, good. Let's try it again now. There we go. Oh, ouch. Okay, now, is this a bull day or a bear day on the street? Don't be bashful about it, for God. This one isn't complicated at all.
A little bit of a bear day.
I think that's putting it. I mean, this isn't a black swan. Now, the term black swan is referring to one of those apocalyptic down days, 5%. But this is a good, hard down day. Notice the interesting thing. See that pattern? The biggest companies, the ginormous 30 of the earth, down up 1%. And then the largest 500 has huge companies, but they're not at all nearly as all as big as the Dow 30, down up 1.5%. And then the little companies, the small caps, those thousands and thousands of little companies, they just got a butt beating today. So you see the risk, the greater the risk, the greater the potential for up and down in a market like this. This was a rough day for the bulls. Now for the bears, just to give you an example, I saw this coming late last night, early this morning, and I got a bear position, a hard bear position in derivatives. Excuse me. And so I threw in $100, and right now I am almost $140. So in one day I've pulled 40%, just being a bear. So there's no reason for you to believe that, well, only a bull market is where you can make money. No, you can make money in any market. Now, obviously, I have taken money from someone who lost money, and I do feel bad about. No, I don't. Whenever there's a win, there's a loss. Someone on the other side of this, I have his lunch money today. And by the time it's over, I'll probably have some of his dinner money too. And maybe if I had enough money, I would have probably taken away his kids' college money too. That's the reality of these markets. We can't care at all about what's going on the other side of it. Sort of like when I eat bacon, I don't think about that poor pig, delicious as it was. Anyway, yeah, this was a good day for me. It was a very bad day if you were a bull, just like the bull that was talking to you. He got his head torn off by the bear. Now, interestingly here, crude got drawn into this maelstrom today. It held only about 45 cents, a half a percent. But still, when you've got a market that really wants to get crude to go to $100 a barrel, and it got 45 cents shaved off it, well, that's a pretty strong day. Now, let's look at the metals here. Ooh, the metals got spanked. Silver is just getting creamed. So money was flowing out of stocks. It was flowing out of liquid commodities. It was flowing out of the metal commodities, the hard commodities. So where was it going? Ah, there it is. There's your daddy right there. The yield went down almost eight basis points, and yield goes down, price goes up. That means investors were pulling money out of stocks and gold, and they were moving it to the safety of bonds, the safe harbor of bonds. Now again, bonds are a safe harbor because they get paid before shareholders can see a dime. If you don't pay, if the company doesn't give the shareholders a dividend, or the price of the stock goes down, the shareholders can cry. If the bondholders aren't paid, well, they'll just turn the company off and take all the assets and chop them up and send everyone on their way. So the bond market going up was clearly what we call a flight to quality, moving from higher risk assets to lower risk assets. This was a defensive day. Now, let me make sure you understand that on a bear day, sometimes that can be an opportunity. Because in a hurricane down market, everything is pulled down. And that's where fundamental analysis can help you out. You can look at individual stocks and say, really? Did this really need to go down like that? You can find bargains. Bargain hunters will come in after a day like this, and they'll scrounge around and find some good buys and go long, in other words, buy, go long, some stocks that fundamentally there was no reason for them to be slaughtered like everything else, but they were in portfolios, and the whole portfolio with these machine traders trading, the whole portfolio was sold out, shaved off, and so good as well as bad went down. And so there are opportunities after a day like this for some bullish positions to be taken. Going over here, yeah, Bitcoin is just getting potty trained. Ethereum, I mean, I have Ethereum in my crypto wallet because I have to use that to pay gas fees for my NFT art. But I mean, other than that, right now, I'm going long stablecoins. And if you know anything about that, stablecoins are actually derivatives. They are cryptos that are tied to actual hard assets, like currencies, like the dollar. And they are a nasty world. Stablecoins are very popular now in the dark world. Illegal trafficking and weapons, or even slightly gray market trafficking and all kinds of things. Terrorists are using them to move funds from the planners to the executors. They are rough stuff, but they are also a very good prospective investment in my judgment. And again, remember that if I am advising you, you might as well have my cat advise you. My cat is under here. Matilda is asleep right now, so she can't give you advice, but if she could, it'd be as good as mine. Financial Times was spanked. Interestingly, notice the Nikkei. It's dark over there. These markets aren't running right now, but you see how they're at the near after about midday in Tokyo, the 225 started pulling upward. So there were a lot of bulls who waited for the slaughter to end, and then they came in and they collected up some stakes. That's what I would see there. And that might mean, okay, we're going into the weekend. I'm going to look at the aftermarket. I'm going to hold my bear positions through the weekend. But I'll tell you, I'm going to keep an eye on this because this worries me that there are some bullish sentiments that might spread, and I might need to get TF out right away on Monday morning before the bulls suddenly find their second wind. Give me a second here. This was definitely a bear day, and there are a lot of good reasons for a bear day. I mean, we've got inflation, so the Fed is going to start clamping down on the money supply. Supply of money goes down, the price of money, interest rates, are going to go up. That's going to mean that we're going to have a slowing economy. But the export sector will do well with that, because when interest rates go up, our goods actually get cheaper overseas, so our export industries will benefit. So as we go through this course, this is fundamental analysis. You think about industries, and then you work your way down to what companies, which industries are going to benefit in any given economic regime, which industries are going to be harmed, and then you look at the companies in the industry to see who are the strong players, who have the competitive advantages and all of that. It's not fun like looking at stock charts and all of that and doing all these weird algorithms that that you can get from these places like Robinhood and TD Ameritrade. It's more fundamental, but it is how you do things if you want to play in a world, whether the sun is shining or it is dark and gloomy and there are storms all around you. And I will teach you about that through this course. Whether you want me to or not, you're going to come out of here a little bit more sophisticated than the typical investor. So when you go into Reddit, there will be times when you, Wall Street Bets and things like that, you'll know that they're on track, but you'll also know when to roll your eyes and say, oh God. Anyway, enough of that for the day. We'll be doing that a lot in this class. Let me get on to some of the content that is important to me in Chapter 2. Money is short-term funds. Capital is long-term funds. Okay, we've got that. No doubt about that. We know how that works. Now, what are we talking about in terms of money and capital flows around the world? On any given day, that's in the quadrillions of dollars. Within 10 years, it'll be in the quintillions every day. All of this money and capital swirling all around everyone, and almost no one has any idea of this. Their ideas about the importance of them in the world, or their ideas and all this kind of stuff, once you get a sense of what is actually happening out there, you have to realize that you're not going to shape this. You are going to play it. You're going to ride those waves. And if you're stupid, you're just going to be swallowed up by them, and you'll figure out some conspiracy theory as to why your life sucks and everyone else's or someone else's doesn't. This is the world of finance. Now, in that world, there are reservoirs of money and capital, huge reservoirs and small reservoirs. Money and capital, these are called surplus economic units. They have money and capital, and it needs to do something. And then there are also deficit economic units. They need money and capital, and they need to find those who have it. Before I begin that too much, though, this vast ocean of currents of money and capital provides an insane amount of liquidity that makes the world very different from what it was even 100 years ago. Liquidity, and this is a definition, is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted to another asset. I'll repeat that, but let me warn you that you go on the internet, you will find a definition that is wrong. I will make sure that that definition is on your test so that you will show me that you cheated and went to the internet to get an answer. That definition on the internet, I will tell it to you here in a minute. But liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted to another asset. Now, some assets are highly liquid, some assets are highly illiquid. This is a highly liquid asset. Do you see this? I can efficiently, at extremely low cost, virtually no cost, I can turn this asset into another asset. I can turn this into a burger. I can turn this into a drink. I can even turn a bunch of these into a friend for a while. Now, a house is a highly illiquid asset. I cannot efficiently. It will take me time, time is money, and it'll also cost me transactions fees to turn a house into another asset, like a meal or another house. Now, one more time, liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted to another asset. Now, let me tell you the definition you'll find on the internet, or a variation on it. It will say, if liquidity is the ease with which an asset can be turned into cash. Now, that's wrong at two points. Ease is a fluff term. It has no meaning. What do you mean, ease? Do we put 10W40 on it so it'll slide along? Efficiency is the correct word. Efficiency carries the meaning of cost. Efficiency, the higher the efficiency, the lower the cost of the transaction. The other part is efficiency is the ease with which an asset can be converted into cash. Well, that would be ridiculous because if we're talking about cash, what its liquidity is, you're using the definition in the definition. Cash is highly liquid because it can be turned into cash very easily. What? No. You can't use ease, you need to use efficiency, and you can't say cash, you have to say another asset. I can turn this dollar, yeah, I could turn it into cash, but I can turn it into a lot of other assets. So remember that. Now let me talk about that vast ocean of money and capital. There has to be a way for the surplus economic units and the deficit economic units to find each other. The markets of the world are highly, highly sophisticated and quite efficient if you know how to do it. The seasoned corporation, the intelligent investor, the person who needs money for a home will know how to access those markets, money and capital markets. This is one of the problems that I encounter, and it's just so compelling. In developing countries where I'm trying to give my assistance, they are not connected to those markets. They're looking desperately. In one case, a country in Africa, they needed a huge amount of capital. So where did they go? The only place they could think of going was to the World Bank, which screwed them, I mean royally screwed them, on the deal. The same I see in other countries too, where they don't have the connections. And also, they're not prepared for that world of surplus economic units. In terms of such matters, as I've mentioned, transparency, in terms of the rule of law, in terms of the way that they conduct their affairs of state. And until they can do that, these capital markets are going to be like invisible. They just aren't there for them. If you were a sophisticated trader working in a brokerage house and you needed $5,000 to do a quick trade, boom, it's right there. But some desperate little company in a third world or a second world country, it has no idea where to go to get that kind of money or that kind of capital. That's why we, in our world, as it's becoming more and more sophisticated, we are laying out this framework of ground rules. You come to us, you had better have your major act together. That means you have stable political institutions. You're not having a right-wing dictator taking over or a military coup every couple of years. You're not having these violent militias going through the countryside killing people. Even more, more sophisticated, you are getting your act together about your carbon footprint. Corporations in the developed world have had enough of this. It's not global warming is just some theory or, well, that's just your opinion, man. We know it's there, and we're bracing for it. We know we have got to have everything in place, because in 20 years, if we have not fixed this, at least gone a lot further than where we are now, we have got ungodly problems happening. So your corporation better understand what the circumstances of our understanding of the world are right now. The same applies to a certain extent to human rights even. We can't deal with your country if you are constantly doing horrible things to a large percentage of your population. Get over it. Get yourselves together, work as a team, and then we can talk to you. But until you can do that, get the hell out of our capital markets. Now, that sounds it's kind of liberal, but it isn't. This is just the reality of capitalism. We are vicious as hell. I have no problem whatsoever about taking someone's lunch money in my trades today. I know someone's going to lose money because I'm making money. But at the same time, overall, we need to have rules. And that's what these capital markets are all about. And the money markets, too. Now, let me distinguish here. Like, for example, in money markets, large creditworthy corporations have a constant need for quick money. So how they do this? For 30 days, $10 million. Well, there is a highly sophisticated market for that, but only for corporations that are large, creditworthy, and they do everything by the book. What the corporation will do is it will issue what is called commercial paper. It's 30-day paper. And there is this insanely huge pool of money available to lend that money to them. It works on a what's called a discount paper. In other words, the company says, we will borrow $9,980,000, and in 30 days, we'll pay you $10 million. That's called discount paper. The interest is that difference between what the lender lends and what they get back in 30 days. It's done in some markets. Even the government does it with its T-bills. But anyway, okay, great. There are corporations out there that just love this stuff. Investors, like, great example, there's a company that I know the people in the Treasury right here in right in Bloomington. They get in a check for $2 million. Okay. We don't have to pay anyone for like 12 days. So they buy a commercial paper. And then they'll sell it to some other investor in 12 days who might ride it for the other 18 days, something like that. But you see, the money is always working. That's cash flow management. Matter of fact, we're talking about actually bringing back a course that I would teach in that, because it's so huge. It's such a big thing these days with corporations, cash flow management. Okay, on the other hand, a company wants to borrow $100 million for 30 years. Okay. That would be a capital market transaction. Well, there is plenty of capital out there more than happy to buy that bond paper from that corporation. In other words, lend them the $100 million, collect interest checks every 6 months for 30 years, and then the company would pay back the $100 million. It's all out there. And it's, if you know where the money is, where the capital is, if you have the connections, it's just a matter of phone calls, or now these days even electronic stuff. Yeah, it's that simple. Matter of fact, I didn't even get how simple it was. I was allowed to watch it was $2 million, just a couple clicks of button, and there it was in the money market, making a little bit of interest for 12 days, and then they'd sell the paper with another click of a button, and then they'd have it, and they could write checks for their bills for it. God, that's efficiency. Okay, now, financial intermediation is matching the surplus and the deficit units. They could be people, households, small businesses, governments, other kinds of institutions, trust funds, whatever. But financial intermediation is matching them. Now, that doesn't have to go through banks, absolutely. I'll go through some of the places where financial intermediation happens. But there are three critical parts to it. You come to me and you say, Professor C, I should like to borrow $100. I've got 20. Okay, so the first one for a financial intermediation to work, to match, would be level amount. The surplus and the deficit unit have to be willing to trade the same amount. Okay, well, I got 100. Okay, we go to the next one. Well, Professor C, I'll pay you back in a month. Look, most I can do is a week, because I really want to go to Red Robin and eat cheeseburgers to up my cholesterol level, because I'm feeling kind of a little too good these days. I can't do it for more than a week. Okay, so timing. Tell you what, okay, a month. So we got a match on the second level. Level and timing. Now, well, you know, Professor C, I don't have a job. What? Well, I'm good for the money, Professor C. No! Stop it! That's too risky. Third level. The risk levels have to match. The surplus unit has to be willing to take the risk of the deficit unit. So the three rungs, the three steps on the ladder, level, that's amount, timing, how long, and risk. And that's what financial intermediation does, is it matches those with the same characteristics on the three criteria and puts them together. So there you go. That's the basic process. Now, banks can do this. Retail banks, your typical bank, they could probably do it on a quick loan. Those payday places do it. They're willing to take huge risk for 2 weeks for amounts up to $500 or whatever. But banks are pretty typical for such matching as car loans and home loans and for personal loans for vacations or whatever. So they can do that. But then you go up to another level of financial intermediaries, commercial banks. Now, they are heavies. They deal with, for one thing, commercial banks are banks for banks. They do the banking for other banks. And they also do banking for very large corporations and medium-sized corporations. That's a commercial bank. Intermediaries at a larger level. Then there are these combination things. I don't think the book talks much about them, where they do a lot of different types of intermediation. But taking those off to the side, like, for example, a Citibank is like a whole bunch of different types of banks all under the holding company, Citicorp. But now, one that is important are these financial services banks. They don't do just those typical, well, loans and checking accounts. They do a whole range of services like financial advising, planning, things like that. They're more like one-stops. A lot of these small banks that are mostly retail are now trying to step into the world of more financial services types of banks. Now, we get into the big leagues, the IBs, the investment banks. All they do is buy primary offerings in IPOs and seasoned offerings. In other words, when Facebook went public, no, it didn't sell that stock to the public. It sold it to an investment banking syndicate that had made a firm commitment underwriting. Those banks bought that, and then they sold it. First, they made sure that their wealthiest clients got in on the action, and then they pumped that stock up into the sky, and then they dropped that mother right down through the floor once mom and pop had it. Rivian. I think I showed you Rivian. The investment banking syndicate bought the initial public offering. They bought it. And then they pumped it up into the sky, and then they and their wealthy clients dumped it once the suckers had bought it. That's an IB, an investment bank. Now, there are these monster international ones, and then there are regionals that are still huge. I mean, I took my students up to a few years back to a regional in Chicago. They have offices in Chicago, New York, Dallas, L.A. I think they are in Miami, Atlanta. I mean, these regionals are huge too, but they're just not quite as huge as the ginormous ones. And then there are really small ones too. But IBs are financial intermediaries. They make sure that they are the surplus economic unit temporarily. And then the deficit economic unit is Rivian, Facebook, whatever is going public. And then they sell it into the secondary market. Now remember, the primary market is where the company gets money. The secondary market is where it's just investors buying and selling from each other, finding out who's the greater sucker. Okay, there are other ones too. Pension funds are a huge pool of money and capital investing to grow the premiums that are deposited by the by people putting into their pensions for the future. And so that is an enormous wellspring. And then there are one that I don't think the book even mentions, life insurance companies, are just insanely huge resources for very long-term capital surplus. Look, you are going to die someday. It's going to hurt like hell. You're going to bitch, and then you're going to be quiet. So will I. Okay, well, that's... Along the way, we're going to pay into a life insurance policy if we're responsible for our family's future after we're dead. And so, you see, they don't need that money back. The life insurance company doesn't need that money back for 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years. So they are really interested in long-term investments way out there in the future. So they would be a surplus economic unit, level, huge, timing, long, risk, it's actually, believe it or not, that's not very risky because we have actuary tables. We know the average of when a person of a specific age and specific other factors is going to die. So these are actually not that risky. As a matter of fact, life insurance companies and banks and pension funds are huge investors in school bonds and municipal bonds, other types of municipal bonds. Because if it's a revenue bond, then the school district is going to tack on some extra taxes on people's property. So the money's going to be there. It's low risk. These schools need, not huge, but they, build a nice new high school or something like that. And timing. Well, it's on a long period. These are usually like 20-year bonds. So, yeah. So there are all these different places out there. Now, getting into a little bit deeper stuff. Mutual funds. mutual funds take money from individuals, households, even sometimes trust funds and things like that. And I want to take a chance here to mention something about trust funds. And then those mutual funds invest in a portfolio. Now, you can jump into a mutual fund. I mean, there are literally, I want to say even hundreds of thousands of them, families of funds from places like Fidelity, PIMCO, TIA. I mean, they're just all over the place. A couple of things about the mutual funds. When you invest in them, you are actually becoming an owner in a sense. You put in this money and you see this little number. That's your share of the company now, the mutual fund. And these mutual funds, you can invest in, I mean, there's mutual funds that are international portfolio, healthcare, green energy, emerging technologies, emerging countries. I mean, anything you want and any beta you want, you can find it. So for a lot of people, this is good stuff. Really good stuff. You can, like, for example, one thing that I've sometimes recommended to people who wanted some informal advice, I just say, okay, if you think the economy is doing good, maybe go into an equity mutual fund, 70%, and into a bond fund, 25%, and then hold cash at 5%. Now, when I say hold cash, that might mean a mutual fund that's in treasury bills, which we call cash. Quick, dirty, efficient. To get in and out. And then if you think the economy's really bad, I'd say, well, let's back up here. Let's go the other way. Maybe 30% equity, 55% bonds, and then 15% cash. So you can do this with mutual funds. You can just pick them out. They're that easy. A couple of things about them. One is that there are mutual funds that are high load. You have to pay a pretty substantial fee to join their party. Don't ever do that. I don't care oh my God, we're making so much money, but you have to pay them $5,000 to start. Don't do that. Then there are low load and no load. I recommend no load. There are plenty of funds out there. They don't ask you for a fee. They just say, come on in, join us. They might ask you for a minimum start, like $50, $100, $250, but you're not paying a fee just to have the privilege of joining. Now, another thing is you want to always watch out, and this is true for the next one, ETFs and ETNs. Look at what the management fee is, management expense ratio. I don't recommend anything above 0.30%. Otherwise, those guys who are running this fund are paying themselves too much of what they make. Now, that brings us to the next one, ETFs. An ETF is literally nothing but an index portfolio. So if there's an ETF that is SPY, that is the Standard & Poor's 500. In other words, there is a portfolio that literally is every stock in the S&P 500. And then you buy a share of that ETF. So with the SPDR, I buy a share of the SPDR for about $460, whatever it is right now. I own the S&P 500. I've got it. That's it right there. That's the S&P 500. So you can sound really hot. Well, yes, I invest in the Standard & Poor's 500. That's right. All 500 of the companies. Well, you do. And you get perfectly balanced portfolio. They set the ratios of the different stocks to be what we consider to be the ideal, and I'll be teaching you about that if you want to do this yourself. And they're experts at it. They're right there at the exchanges, and you can buy and sell the shares anytime you want. Now, mutual funds, it's not quite that easy. In some cases, you can't change mutual funds within a family except for a certain number of times a year. Well, that's okay. I mean, if you want to be a hot trader, now, I mean, you can get ETFs that are all stock portfolio. Like, I could buy the NASDAQ. There is an ETF that is the NASDAQ, and I could buy a share of that thing. There is There are ETFs that are bond. So I could even use ETFs to create that economy-sensitive portfolio. I'd buy an ETF that was a pile of the spider. I'd buy 60% of my money would be in the spider. Then I'd buy an ETF that was AGG. That's a bond fund. And, I mean, you can see they post the beta of the fund, and okay, great. And then I would hold some in cash in an ETF that was treasury bills or something like that, or money market mutual fund of, or maybe the rest in a mutual fund that was a money market. Yeah. So the idea that, well, I've got to buy and sell a lot of stocks and all that. God, don't do that. These are out there. And let the pros who are right there on the exchanges, who make their dinner money improving your position, let them do the legwork, for gosh sake. Here I am talking like that, and then I'm buying individual stocks myself because, well, hell, because that's what I do. Okay. Now, there are a couple of other ones. Hedge funds. Hedge funds are very wealthy, wealthy investors putting their surplus into a company. It's like usually like an LLC or a corporation. Now, what a hedge fund does is it provides a service to the outer world. Let me explain. In a course like this, and in every other course except one, I would teach you about responsible investing. Controlling your risk. There's a part of risk that you can get rid of through portfolio diversification. You don't need that. Get rid of that. And then find your risk level. Are you a risky investor? And find the beta for that and get a well-diversified portfolio that averages out to that beta. And hold there. Don't take stupid risk. Risk, as I tell in most classes, and you'll hear me say this over and over again, risk is a demon. It's waiting to hurt you. But then there's another side of the market. I teach one course. It's derivatives. Futures, options, swaps, caps, forwards, that stuff. And the first day of that class, I tell my students, many of whom had me for other classes, I say, in our world, in the world of derivatives, risk is God. Because we're the speculators. We take the opposite position of the risk averse. They need to get rid of risk. We're the ones who are going to take it off their shoulders for a fee. Today, I took early this morning, I took a high-risk position by taking the risk away from those who didn't want it. Well, I'm going to take their money anyway, but there's that. Hedge means that you are removing risk. So, for example, you have a nice fat portfolio. It's gone up a lot. Well, if the stock market goes to hell, you lose everything, right? No, you don't. Not if you're intelligent, because you can sell the risk of a collapse to a speculator on the other side. That's a hedge. Ouch. That's a hedge. Okay? Now, let me give you a little more insight into that. A corn farmer. He or she is in the business of growing corn. He or she is most decidedly not in the business of corn price volatility. For God's sake, that's not what they do. So you know what I can do? See, if corn prices go up, that farmer makes a great money for that year. If corn prices go down, that farmer can be bankrupt. What I can do is I can set up a hedge so that when corn prices go down, the farmer loses on the corn but wins on my opposite position that I've made for him. If corn prices go up, he makes a fortune on the opposite position even though he takes a butt bath on the corn. What that means, though, is that over time, I can make sure that that farmer's income, it isn't perfect. Obviously, hedges aren't that good. But I can make it so that that corn farmer in any given year can make $70,000 to $80,000 a year, regardless of corn prices. That's a hedge. I can make sure that you, a trucking company, if diesel prices go up, that trucking company has less profit. It's hurt badly. If diesel prices go down, well, the company makes more, a big profit. But you see, the trucking company isn't in the business of diesel price volatility. It's in this the business of, guess what? Trucking. So I can set up a hedge so that when diesel prices go down, the company loses on the diesel even as it makes more profit. And if diesel prices go through the roof, it loses on profit, but it makes a lot of money on the diesel futures. But overall, I'm taking away a risk that was there, that the company did not have any business taking. You see, in a lot of ways, I don't have sympathy. Well, I lost all my money in the stock market. Well, that's because you didn't want to pay a little bit of money to the speculators to take the other side in a hedge. You wanted to take that risk, and then you found out risk can mean good times if your stock prices go up, but it can also mean that your kids don't go to Illinois State University. They end up at some community college, if that. Now, those are hedge funds. Now, there's one last one. They're dirty, they're evil, they're terrible. I'm trying to get one started. I'm working on it in Central America. They're called private equity funds. Private equity funds, essentially, you're a company in trouble. Well, what we'll do is we'll come in and we'll say, okay, here's what we're going to do. You give us a nice plug of stock in your company, and then we're going to find $100 million in debt. We'll arrange for it. We know where the capital markets are, and they do. And in exchange, you're going to do what we tell you to do. You're going to lay off a pile of people, get rid of them. You're going to outsource all of your production to China, to Guangdong province. And you're going to close these stores, and we're going to hype your company, and they will. Oh, by the way, here's the document for the $120 million you borrowed. I will explain them later, futures. Yes, I will. Someone asked about futures. Okay, here's what I'm going to do for you. $120 million. Wait, you said $100 million. Well, yeah, $20 million is our fee. You mean we're borrowing money to pay you? Well, yes, you are. And you're also giving us that stock. And then what we're going to do after we've signed the deal with that company, the private equity firm has signed the deal with that desperate company, we're going to pump that stock through the roof. The turnaround artists have come in, and we're going to do everything. We get every fool, every sucker, and every amateur and day trader to buy into that when we pump the stock up, and then we're going to dump that thing and drive that stock through the ground after we have cashed our stock out to those suckers. And then the company's going to be in real trouble because we really didn't do anything for it. And it's going to go into bankruptcy because we forced it to, because they couldn't pay the coupon payment, the interest, on the debt that we saddled them with. And then we'll take that company in bankruptcy and we'll break it up into little pieces and sell it to our friends. Why are you wrecking this company? Because it was wreckable. That's a private equity fund. Not pleasant world, is it? So here's the thing. Stay away from the players because they will take you. Remember what I told you? The house always wins. Always. I will see you on Monday in person. That's all I have for you today. I thank you for being my students.